From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The use and control of fire are behavioral characteristics that distinguish humans from other animals. Now, a new study by Iowa State University anthropologist Jill Preetz reports that savanna chimpanzees in Senegal have a near-human understanding of wildfires and change their behavior in anticipation of the fire's movement. Also, one of Preetz's artifacts, a spear-shaped tool made by chimps, will be featured in an upcoming exhibit at the Smithsonian. This hour, we talk with Jill Preetz and Ben Beck of the Great Ape Trust of Iowa. What can chimps tell us about human origins? First, this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our second half hour, we look at how restructuring at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines will eliminate jobs and limit visitors to this primate research center. But first, we look at new studies on chimpanzees by a world-renowned Iowa State University anthropologist and what these observations may tell us about human evolution. The use and control of fire are behavioral characteristics that distinguish us humans from other animals. Now, a new study by Iowa State University anthropologist Jill Preetz reports that savanna chimpanzees in Senegal have a near-human understanding of wildfires and change their behavior in anticipation of the fire's movement. The new study appears in the 2010 edition of the American Journal of Physical Anthropology. Jill Preetz is an associate professor of anthropology at Iowa State University. She joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Professor Preetz.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the show again. We talked, I think it was just over a year ago, but some new things to catch us up on. You collected data on the chimps' behavior with seasonal fires, and this was in 2006 at your research site in Senegal. What did you observe?
Well, I knew that the chimps had experience with fire. They deal with wildfires that sweep through their home range every year. But I just, during that period, happened to be with them when they encountered the fire. And so I was really struck by their, I would even call it nonchalance in terms of how they behaved around the fire. I listened again to the audio tape I made last night, and it really was pretty amazing in terms of how calm they were compared to how nervous I was. But they were really, I would say, expert at predicting how the fire would behave and how to gear their behavior in response to it.
So while you, as a human, and the other humans who were with you, were interpreting this as possibly a threatening fire to you and the chimps, they were not at all worried.
No, I was very threatened. Actually, I was by myself. I like to be out with the chimps by myself. And so if I would have had one of my Senegalese field assistants, I know they would have been much calmer than I was, because they also experience fires yearly. But the chimps were amazingly calm. There was just no sign of fear whatsoever. And with chimps, it's pretty easy to see that. And so I really, you know, in one of the cases, I felt safe only because I was able to follow the chimps and feed off of their behavior. So I was really sticking with them. That was my way of feeling safe in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. So what does this calm, relatively calm behavior tell you about how chimps may think of fire?
Well, it really, my co-author and I really were interested in applying this case to trying to better understand human evolution. And the control use and use of fire is, some say, as unique as spoken languages to humans. And so there's fairly sketchy evidence for early use of fire. And really, the best evidence only dates back to several hundred thousand years ago, even though some claim it could be millions of years old. And the way we use our information is to look at chimps who have a pretty small brain size compared to humans, and basically saying that if they have this sort of sophisticated way of dealing with fire, there's really no reason to think that early hominids, so Australopithecines that lived 4 million years ago or so, there's no reason to think that perhaps these bipedal apes, perhaps our ancestors, perhaps they were characterized by the same type of abilities.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that early hominids, not humans, but could have started fires and used fires?
I think they could have controlled fires, definitely, given, you know, if we use chimps as a model and assume that the last common ancestor of chimps and humans, which lived around 6 million years ago or so, had the same type of intelligence. It's no great leap, I think, to think that Australopithecines were able to control fire use. Actually making fire, though, is another question.
Right.
And what we did was also sort of take the levels of fire use and move backwards. And so you talk about the control of fire first and then making fire and hominid evolution. We kind of just backed up and said, well, first of all, you have to have this understanding of the complexity of fire and be able to be comfortable in its presence in order for the next steps to occur. And so that's how we used our information.
So this troop knew that what based on the winds or how the fire was, how they were observing the fire, that they could evade it, that they would not be in danger?
Right. That's how I perceived their behavior. And we were literally around it for, you know, hours. And they have to take into account things like the wind speed, also the fuel that the fire will consume. And so there were areas of very tall, dry grass. There were areas where you had had a previous burn a month ago. And so the burn wouldn't be as intense there. And then they had to deal with topography. We were in an area of a dry stream bed, and so the fire would move, leap from the bank of the stream bed over the stream bed. And so the speed varied as well. So there are a number of different things they took into account in making their moves. And the thing is, significantly, it was during this one particular fire was during the heat of the day. And in Senegal, that's, I think I recorded 105 degrees, and that's in the shade. And so this is at a time when the chimps normally want to just sit in the shade and rest, not move around in the sun. And that's something, too, that I think induced them to try to minimize the energy they expended in leaving and escaping from the fire. So they really timed it down, I thought, down to the last second. There was an instance when I could feel the heat from the wall of the fire, the flames, and I actually had to sort of push through the chimps and move to the other side because I was just too nervous to be around it. They kind of looked at me funny.
Was it evident that the entire troop had this knowledge, or was one directing or a couple directing them and sort of teaching them about the nature of fire?
I did see, it seemed to me like all of the individuals were equally calm, but they definitely would feed off certain individuals. So there was a juvenile male who would stick close to his mother. And there was a dominant male there as well. In one case, he let off travel a little ways, but in another case, he stayed behind and someone else let off travel. And so it seemed that definitely the adults were moving and leading travel, but it varied. There were a couple adult females and there were some adult males as well. And there wasn't one individual that led travel each time.
You've observed these chimps doing something that you've called not a rain dance, but a fire dance. What is that?
I sort of labeled that following Jane Goodall's description of what she called a rain dance. And it's really a display is what it is. So males do, they display a lot. Male chimpanzees display a lot. And this can involve exaggerated movements and throwing branches and dragging branches and throwing rocks, etc. Before a rainstorm, and this is seen at every site where chimps have been observed, what you have is what Jane Goodall called a rain dance, and it's a real exaggerated display, and it's not directed towards other individuals. And in some areas, it's in slow motion almost, and that's what you see at my site, Fongoli. And so what I saw in response to the fire was that the dominant male in the group also exhibited this type of really slow motion, exaggerated display. It wasn't towards individuals in the group. It seemed to be in response to this threatening sort of force. And so I termed it the fire dance. A fire display would be a better
So what is the dance about? What can you speculate that chimp is communicating, just a celebration of it or a communication to the others? Here it comes? Or?
Oh, I don't know if I'd say that it's a communication. I think maybe on one level it is, but I think I agree with Goodall's and others' interpretations that it's a response by a male to something that he has no control over. I think Goodall has even sort of speculated about maybe this is the glimmerings of religion. Is it evolved in our own species? I don't think I want to go there. But
well, that there's a great force out there that's now in our presence and And I'm going to recognize it with my movements, maybe, something like that.
Right. And there is some degree of, I wouldn't call it fear, but nervousness. And the same thing happens when there's a rainstorm. I mean, you have in Senegal, you know, these violent rainstorms and branches crash down. And all the individuals get fairly nervous. And you can ask, you know, any of my students that have been there with me, they're harder to follow during a rainstorm. And I would say that the fire is the same sort of, I think it's a more, obviously more of a dangerous situation, but the male's response, this display to the fire, is similar to that one. So some nervousness and just a reaction on his part, a big display.
Now, can you teach a chimp to start a fire?
Oh, sure. You definitely can. In fact, down at the Great Ape Trust, I know you'll talk about that a little later, Kanzi, a bonobo, has been taught to start a fire. And so I think there's...
How does he do it? This matches or flint or...
Oh, I'm not... What I've seen just on film is that he actually uses one of those fire starters. So I'm not sure about with a match. I think that's kind of an easy way to start. But I think that you probably could. I think with Kanzi, you'd have no problem teaching him how to use a match. And actually, he makes stone tools. So, if they really wanted to try to teach him this, he could probably learn it. I think that chimps are capable. And in fact, I think a lot of other primates would perhaps show some of these same capabilities that chimps show, but we really had a hard time finding information on him.
Now, I understand you'll be returning to Senegal this spring to continue your research. Along these lines with fire, will you be looking at something more specific?
Well, I definitely will be there during the fire season. So I leave actually in about 10 days. And one thing that is sort of on my plate that's new is that I'll be spending the night out with the chimps, because what we see is that they move around and travel and even feed at night. And that's something that's unique to chimps as well. I think it's my hypothesis is that it's a response to the heat. And so that's something I'm going to focus on at least for the first couple of months when I go out there. I know I will run into fires. I don't know if I'll be with chimps when I run into fires, but that's definitely something that I'm going to keep my eye open for.
So you're sleeping out. You said you do this alone, right?
Yes.
And so you bed down near the chimps, with the chimps?
I do. I try not to get too close. Well, I have a pretty conservative protocol in that we try to keep 10 meters from the chimps at all time. I want to get close enough to where I can actually hear or see them move around at night. And I've done this before, maybe probably not more than a dozen times. I really want to intensify that, though. The thing is, it takes a lot out of me when I spend the night out there. I don't really sleep, and so then I have to take a day off. I have observed them moving around at night. They make nests. We've seen some really interesting behaviors that I don't think have been reported elsewhere. And again, I think it's because they live in such a harsh habitat that they need to resort to behaviors like this in order to survive. And so almost every really interesting thing that comes out of this site, I think, can be tied back into that habitat, which is why I chose this site.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to take a break here. Professor Preetz is with us, Jill Preetz, anthropologist from Iowa State University. We'll talk about an artifact that she brought back, a spear-shaped tool made by chimps, when we return. It'll be featured in an upcoming exhibit at the Smithsonian. This hour, talking with Jill Preetz, and also later, Ben Beck of the Great Ape Trust of Iowa. Your questions for Jill Preetz, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Back with The Exchange with anthropologist Jill Preetz of Iowa State University, talking about her new study of chimpanzees in Senegal, having a near-human understanding of wildfires. And we want to continue our discussion because, Jill Preetz, you have an artifact that you brought back from Senegal, a spear-shaped hunting tool used by these savannah chimpanzees. It's to be displayed at a new exhibition hall opening next year at the Smithsonian's National Museum of History. The exhibit, to open March 17th, is dedicated to the discovery and understanding of human origins. Describe the artifact, this spear-shaped hunting tool.
Well, this was a tool used by a young female Nicol, and she is one of the most prolific spear hunters. And it's basically a very stout, sturdy stick. It's about 65 centimeters long, which is about average for those types of tools. And the thing about Nicol, as well as a couple of these other females, is that they go a step further in making their tools. So there are a series of about 5 steps that almost every chimp takes in making the tools. And these particular chimps go further than they do what we would call sharpening the tip. So they really trim the tip with their teeth and effectively makes it into a sharp point. And the Smithsonian specifically wanted one of the tools that had been whittled at the end. And so I sent it out, and I'm looking forward to going and seeing it.
Mm, so tell us what these chimps do with these spear-like weapons.
Well, what they do is they hunt a particular type of mammal, and this is another primate. It's actually a nocturnal prosimian. It's a bush baby is the common name. So these are very small primates. Think of a guinea pig, perhaps, sized animal with a very long tail. And they are active at night, so during the day they sleep in tree hollows. And what the chimps do is they fashion these tools, and they basically spear into the holes with the tools to get bush babies. And we reported this a couple of years ago. We had about 22 instances, and I'll say that as of today, we're up to 90 tool-assisted hunting bouts, and so we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, this was really quite sensational news in your area of work when this was reported 2 years ago. But according to the National Geographic article that we talked about when this information came out 2 years ago, some primatologists took you to task for overstating this bush baby spearing behavior. Now, has that been laid to rest, that debate that you were making too much of this?
Oh, I don't think it has. But that's what makes it interesting, I guess. What I will say, though, that this spring or sometime, I've been told between April and June, there is a National Geographic documentary coming out on my research. And so there is some footage that hopefully will convince people otherwise. You know, I think we had a fairly small sample size. It was 22 bouts. And like I said, we're up to 90 now. I guess, you know, it was just sort of, surprisingly to me, hard for primatologists to imagine that chimps could systematically hunt with tools like this. But they do it all the time. It's a seasonal thing at Fongoli. It's really a normal part of their behavior. So hopefully after that video comes out, and then we'll eventually publish on this more extensive data set, then people will be better convinced.
The spear that will be on display at the Smithsonian is made by a chimp. Nickel, did you say?
Nickel is her name. Name we gave her.
And you also found out that actually female chimps are more skilled than males at crafting and using tools.
They are, and that definitely has held up. We have seen a few more males use tools, but never, except for one adult male, we've only seen this once in the adult males. And juveniles also exhibit this tool use behavior, but it really is the females who are exhibiting it more than you would expect. And we follow males, in fact, as subjects. And so I think we're just really seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of female behavior.
Hmm. Why would that be? I mean, we know in humans, guys and their tools, you look at a workbench. I mean, not to say, of course, a lot of women work with a lot of tools, but, you know, it's the cliche. So.
Right. Well, it's interesting because in chimps you see the opposite. So even at sites where you have – chimps use tools at almost every site. Termite fishing, for example, which you also see at my site, that's something that females seem to be more skilled at. They practice it more often. And so it to me, and my interpretation of this behavior is that the females in this society and chimp society in general are subordinate to males. And so, for example, when there's feeding competition, if there's a ripe fruit – a fig tree, for example, or something like that. Females are subordinate to males, and the same with hunting behavior. Females can't run down monkeys and grab them like males can. And when males get monkeys, they do share with females, but they also share with adult males. So I think it really is something that the females do in terms of it's a response to this sort of feeding competition problem. So they have to get creative, in other words. They can't, because most of them have babies, again, run down monkeys, and so they have another way of getting at the protein that they need.
Mm-hmm. Now, many of us who are not involved as primatologists, anthropologists, think chimps are chimps, but there are different types of chimps. How are your chimps, Fongoli, different from, say, the chimps of Jane Goodall?
Well, that's really what is most interesting to me is when I chose this particular site, I expected to see differences. They live in a savanna habitat. They're a West African subspecies of chimp, so a different subspecies of chimps that Jane Goodall studied. But still, basically, they're chimps in many ways. They eat ripe fruit. They have the same type of dominance hierarchy among males. But what I have seen when I compare them to chimps that live in forests, including Jane Goodall's work, is that they do exhibit significant differences. And it can all, like I mentioned, I believe, it can be tied back into this savanna habitat. And the reason that is significant is because this type of habitat is the one we think shaped much of early human evolution, is mm-hmm. that some stresses associated with this habitat drove some of the unique things we see in our own lineage.
Mm-hmm. So a savanna, you don't have the large jungle trees. You have to stand more upright. Is that it?
Well, that's really interesting because I had a master's student here at Iowa State do her thesis work on bipedalism. So how often and in what context chimps did stand upright. And when she compared this to other sites, the chimps at my site are upright or bipedal more often than at other sites. I had another Iowa State student pursue that last year. And so we're trying to write that up and figure out why. But they definitely have to travel on the ground almost, 100% of the time. There are trees out there, but I think the average tree is something like 10 meters in height, 30 feet or so. So there are trees. You have woodland habitat that's important to them, but you don't have this sort of, rainforest-type canopy where they can travel in the trees. So it really is provides some challenges for them that you don't find elsewhere.
There have been several moves around the world to get some primates more rights in some countries. There's been even legislation passed limiting experimentation on great apes. Should some of these primates have a legal person status or something akin to that?
You know, I've worked with captivates apes as well as the wild chimpanzees. With the wild chimps, I really try to keep my distance. I try not to influence them. I try to the best of my ability, not to influence them, even though I know my presence does. But, you know, when I worked with captive chimps, I had a much different relationship. And really, I guess I would be in favor of seeing, in a perfect world, all research stopped on captive apes. I'm not anti-biomedical research by any means, but I think that they're definitely an intelligent being that I think if people had experience with, they would be struck at how similar they are to humans, at least emotionally. And so, I definitely am in favor of a move in that direction.
How long has it been since you've seen Nickel and the other chimps?
Oh, I last saw them in August, and I just heard that everyone's doing well, so I'm excited to see them again.
Do you get to miss them?
I do. I do miss them, yeah.
You can't do any Skyping with them, though.
No, I know. That's the thing. I only have to go on secondhand information.
What do they do when – so when you go back in 10 days' time and eventually find them in this area – will they do any displays at seeing you, recognize you?
You know, they do recognize me. And so I always have my Senegalese team there. I have a project manager, Dondo Conte, and he's amazing. So he holds things down when I'm not there. And I usually have a student as well. The chimps, though, it's surprising to me how little of a reaction they give. They'll do maybe a double take. And some individuals, there's a female named Tumbo, seems to sort of come up and take a longer look. But otherwise, it's like, oh, it's you again. And it's interesting because they definitely recognize us and not others because they live alongside people. They are afraid of other people they don't know. And so I have a very small team. It will take people out with us. We try not to take too many people out. So we really want them used to just a small group of people and not people in general. And they are. I mean, we have to hide when we see other people, just like the chimps do and everything like that.
Jill Preetz, I want to ask you to stay put there at Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. When we come back, Jill will remain with us and we'll talk some more about apes, but also be joined by Ben Beck, Conservation Director at the Great Ape Trust. That's a primate research center in Des Moines. And how new restructuring at the Great Ape Trust will eliminate some jobs, limit visitors to the Des Moines Primate Research Center. We'd like to get your questions and comments about this groundbreaking primate research you've been hearing about in the first half hour. And join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Back with Jill Preetz and Ben Beck when we return. Can you own a sound? That's a question we ask my guests tomorrow at this time on The Exchange. Benjamin Franson and Kembru McLeod, they are makers of the new PBS documentary Copyright Criminals, will be my guests. The documentary, which premieres this Sunday, examines the creative and commercial value of music sampling tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we've been heard about new studies on chimpanzees and how they behave around fire, how they interpret fire, use fire, how they create, and also use spear-like tools, what these observations may tell us about human evolution. Jill Preetz is with us, an associate professor of anthropology at Iowa State University. The Great Ape Trust is a 200-acre ape sanctuary and language study in Des Moines that houses orangutans and bonobos. Joining us now, Ben Beck, the conservation director at the Great Ape Trust at this primate research center in Des Moines. He's joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Ben.
Hi, Ben. How are you? Thanks for having us.
Great to have you on the show to join me and Jill. Before we talk about the new restructuring at the Great Ape Trust, remind us briefly of the mission of the Great Ape Trust.
The mission is to conduct research on the way apes think, and this obviously has a great deal of overlap with the sort of wonderful work that Jill is doing in the field. We were also very interested in helping people understand, as Jill alluded, once you get to know about great apes, they take on a completely different meaning for us, and so for humans. And one of our parts of our mission was to try to educate the public more about great apes. We were also, of course, interested in ape conservation, and I hope we can get back to that in a bit. But in order for people like Jill to be able to continue to make the sorts of spectacular discoveries that they've been making, we have to make sure that these apes are saved. And there's only about 20% of the apes left in the world that existed just 100 years ago. So they're disappearing under our watch, and part of Great Ape Trust's mission was to try to slow down or reverse that disappearance. And finally, we were interested in finding great apes that were in less than wonderful circumstances in the United States, in entertainment and circuses and pets, and try to give them a better place to live.
So research,
conservation, education, and sanctuary was our mission.
So how many apes and of what type do you have there?
There are 7 bonobos, which, as Jill said, are a type of chimpanzees that in the wild come from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there are 7 orangutans who in the wild live in – I'm sorry, there are 6 orangutans. In the wild, they live in Indonesia and Borneo.
Mm-hmm. So what is the restructuring that is taking place and why?
Let's start with the why first, Ben. The floods of 2008 were totally unanticipated, and they devastated the Great Ape Trust campus. The floods reached levels that were not anticipated by the Army Corps of Engineers or anybody else. And while the apes were all safe because they could climb up to the tops of their enclosures, the decision now is that we can never build any additional structures on the Great Ape campus. And that really stymies the development of all parts of our mission. At the time the flood struck, we had plans on the drawing boards for a brand new orangutan facility that would allow us to expand our research programs, expand our sanctuary programs, and most of all to meet the demand, the tremendous demand by folks in Iowa and surrounding states to come and visit the Great Ape Trust and learn about the apes and learn about the work that we're doing here. So we realized after the floods of 2008 that we simply could not continue to develop the vision as we had hoped, and that we needed to find additional partners to help us do that. And that turns out to mean that some of our apes are going to have to leave the Great Ape Trust, leave Des Moines, leave Iowa for other places. So that's a kind of downsizing. We're going to lose about half of our apes. All of our orangutans will leave probably by 2013. And, of course, downsizing in staff is a natural consequence of that kind of downsizing of mission.
Did the downturn in the economy nationwide play a part in this as well?
Sure. I think the downturn in the economy touches every aspect of any sort of non-governmental organization that depends on private contributions to continue to prosper and grow.
So is this a case where resources dwindled or the outlook dwindled and there's only enough space, resources for either the orangutans or the bonobos, but not both?
The space is there. The idea, the issue is for us is how are we going to grow this vision? We really need to, there are many apes out there that are living in less than ideal circumstances, and we need to be able to accommodate them. We need to be able to meet the demands for visitation from a large number of not only the public, but also school students and other scientists. And we need to be able to expand our research programs. We had hoped to be able to add chimpanzees and gorillas to Great Ape Trust. Mm-hmm. So the big limiting resource here, Ben, is space and our ability to build additional buildings.
Why was it decided, given these two groups, the bonobos and the orangutans, why did the orangutans have to go?
I think the bonobo research has a very long and rich history. Coming to us from the Language Research Center at Georgia State University. And so the decision was made to continue to work with them. We also were able to identify a partner who was a partner institution that was very interested in acquiring a large number of orangutans for a really ambitious exhibit that was being planned and to be the flagship for a very ambitious and successful conservation program. Mm-hmm.
So the origins of these apes. These apes are not taken from Africa. They are taken from, as you said, circuses or where else?
One of our bonobos was actually taken from the Democratic Republic of Congo by other institutions a long, long time ago, Matata, and she's ended up living at Language Research Center and then at Great Ape Trust. All the rest were born in captivity, and many of them were born at the Language Research Center, and some were actually born in very reputable zoos.
Mm-hmm. I understand a lead orangutan researcher, Robert Schumacher, is made known he's leaving the center. Another one, Serge Witch, already left. They left just because of the de-emphasis on orangutans.
Well, you'd have to ask them why they left, but I think that's a natural conclusion. Clearly, while our interests in conservation have not diminished, there's very little justification for us to continue to support active programs when the orangutans are leaving. So Serge has moved on to the University of Zurich to pursue his wonderful field work on research in orangutans. And while Rob has not made a definite decision about his future, he'll be moving on as well.
Okay, I was quoting the Des Moines Register as confirming that, but it's not that he's leaving. That's not confirmed.
Yes, it is. It is confirmed. Rob will be leaving, but he has not yet made up his mind which of the offers that he has to continue his career that he's going to accept.
I understand part of this restructuring. You mentioned cutting jobs, 10 jobs from the staff of 30 cut. Also, a limit to the number of visitors. How many thus far have been allowed to visit the Great Ape Trust, and how will that change in the next few years?
I think the numbers are we've had about 1,200 to 2,000 visitors from the general public, student groups, visiting scientists per year. And while we have not yet finalized plans for what we can do in 2010, it'll doubtlessly be a smaller number.
Mm-hmm. So in total, in the big picture, how will this restructuring, these cuts, these changes change the focus of the research at the Great Ape Trust?
Well, first focus, of course, will be that there'll be much less research, at least intramural, intra-house research on orangutans. But one thing that will not change will be our focus on conservation. Mm-hmm. We've had a very clear focus on this for a long time. In fact, Great Ape Trust was one of the sponsors of Jill's research in Senegal. And right now we are focused on a program in the country of Rwanda, in which we are trying to save a small population of chimpanzees. And to help the people that live around them. What we all know is, of course, you can't save chimpanzees or any other apes without helping people. And, in fact, you can't help people without saving those chimpanzees and the habitats they live in. So our concentration program, our conservation program, is going to concentrate on these chimpanzees, and it, in fact, is very robust and very active at the moment.
Mm-hmm. This may be a dumb question, but also maybe Jill can chime in here too. But some people may have it. Why have a research facility that studies great apes in Iowa anyway? They're not native to our continent. They're certainly not native to our climate at present, for sure.
Well, that's true, and this is truly a wonderful story. Our founder, Ted Townsend, an industrialist in Des Moines, was able to see gorillas in the wild as an ecotourist in 1996. And as he reports it, his life was transformed by that experience. And he came back and decided he wanted to do something with and for great apes. And at the same time, he wanted to give something back to the city and the state that had been so good to him and his family in terms of their business.
Mm-hmm. And how is the funding then maintained?
The funding to this point is coming almost exclusively from Ted. About 90% of it has come from Mr. Townsend, and that will continue.
You said earlier you wanted to talk more about great ape conservation. What are the threats we have? Are we doing better than we were, say, one or two decades ago, or are we continuing to have these species threatened by various factors?
We're doing better in the sense of public and professional awareness. We have been able to identify the threats, and mainly they all go back to the number of people on the face of this planet and the fact that our levels of consumption are really very considerable. We use a lot of stuff and we use a lot of fuel, and there's more of us, and we're literally going through the Earth's resources, including the habitats of all of these wonderful primates. So we've become more aware of that, and we've begun thinking about how to meet these challenges. But the sad fact is that we really haven't reversed these trends. Every time we take the pulse of any particular population of wild primates, we find that at best they're holding their own, and at worst they're decreasing. Jill can comment on this in terms of Fongoli. But in Rwanda, where we started, we started in a habitat that was about the size of a big city park. Mm-hmm. And there were only 13 chimpanzees at the time. And this habitat had been reduced from something like 140,000 acres to 2,500 acres. And that's pretty characteristic of what's happening with ape habitats. Well, we've stopped the hemorrhage in this Kishwadi forest, and actually have been able to reverse it. We've added about 1,500 acres to the size of this tiny reserve, and actually the population of chimpanzees has grown from 13 to 14 with the birth of an infant last year. So there is reason for hope, and there is reason to expect and hope that we humans will take the responsibility for conserving, preserving the natural world that we live in, and being able to save, especially in the case of great apes, this remarkable living museum of behaviors and attributes of the sort that Jill is uncovering in Senegal.
Jill, when you look back at your decades of research and then on to the outlook of great apes on our planet, what conclusions do you come to that you would like to add to Ben's comments?
Well, you know, I think that Ben said it well in terms of how our global consumption affects basically everything everywhere. And I guess a good example is in southeastern Senegal, and we're working on conserving the chimps in this country. There are only about 400 to 500 left. But an impending project that threatens the extinction of a number of communities is a big iron ore mining project, and that was put on hold because the automobile market crashed. And I mean, it just kind of illustrates how what we do in this country affects chimpanzees in Senegal, for example. And you know, I guess on a big scale, it can be quite depressing. But I think the work that Ben and the Great Ape Trust is doing in Rwanda is incredibly uplifting to see the scale of the project they're doing, which doesn't affect not only the which affects not only the chimps there, but also the people in general. If you get online and read about their project, it's just an amazing effort they've put forth. And I think that you see this quite a bit. I think that we probably can't save every Great ape population that is around today, but I think that they'll definitely be some great efforts put forth to do so.
What are the great apes that are most threatened?
It would be the orangutan, I would say.
Mm-hmm. They exist where now?
Ben talked about those. I would say the Sumatran orang at this point, and there's a cross river gorilla also that is one of the most endangered primate species today.
I grew up saying orangutan, and I know the other pronunciation, the more correct pronunciation, is without that G sound. There is no G in orangutan. Why do we say it that way? Do either of you know?
Ben might want to talk to that.
There's only one G in orangutan.
Yeah, there's not a second one.
And I think it was a transliteration of a native language that in fact, you will find in print in some early natural historians' accounts, the use of the word orangutan. And I think it was just one of those erroneous transliterations of a native language that we've been able to straighten out. But the word itself literally means man of the woods.
Mm. You said, Ben, that being in the presence of a great ape can really change your outlook, your view of these animals, as it did the founder of the great ape. Tell us, for those of us who won't ever have a firsthand encounter with a great ape, what is it that dawns on you, that you experience when you're in the presence of a great ape?
I think, for me at least, what I begin to realize is that humans are not absolutely unique in this biological world. We sometimes feel that around our dogs and our cats, but it's really impactful with great apes. Let me give you an anecdote that I used to work at the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and I retired from there in 2003. And the day of my retirement, I was walking around visiting keepers and visiting animals that I had known for 20 years to say goodbye. And there was one particular orangutan whose name was Inda, a young female orangutan, that I had done quite a bit of work with on cognition, on her thinking. And I walked in and I was talking with the keeper and talking with the Inda, and I went over, and Inda looked at me, and I got all teary. I don't cry very much, but all of a sudden tears started pouring out of my eyes, and I know Inda had never seen me cry. I don't know if she'd seen anybody else cry, but she immediately understood the meaning that I was really, really sad, and she reached out through the mesh. And she put her arm around my shoulder and patted me on the back as if to say, there, things are okay. Mm. Now, how you can get that kind of cross-species recognition of emotional state without understanding that there is a very close affinity between what we call an animal and what we call a human. And it really blurs that line, and that's the part of it that I think to me is so special.
Jill Preetz, you do a lot of communicating with great apes, the chimps you look after there or study. Is it true that chimps get upset if someone laughs at them?
It definitely does. And I have a couple of examples from when I worked with captive chimps. And one was where I had inadvertently laughed at a female who fell while we were playing. And it wasn't very polite of me at all to laugh when she slipped. It just looked so funny. And she actually started crying the way chimps cry and came to me for reassurance because I had, I would say, hurt her feelings. And so that I had a couple of stories that Mary Roach elaborated on in the National Geographic article, although she didn't give the details, probably because it would have made me sound very rude. But yeah, they definitely do. I mean, it's, as Ben said, it's it's just remarkable that there is another being that is so similar to humans. And I just want to say, you know, earlier you talked about why have the Great Ape Trust here. When I heard about the Great Ape Trust coming to Iowa, that was the thing I've always been most excited about, is that it gives people who might not have the opportunity, this ability to see great apes up close and to maybe get a better understanding of these beings. And that's always been, to me, one of the best things about having the Great Ape Trust in Iowa. I think it's a real treasure for the citizens of Iowa and especially students of the universities and other schools in Iowa.
With this downsizing, do you see that, Jill, as a threat to the future of the Great Ape Trust? And to research, I mean, you were obviously here. One of the perks of being here is that you're near the Great Ape Trust.
I don't do research there myself. I definitely enjoy having Ben and the other scientists in Iowa. My students, I've had a number of students conduct research down there. I still have students conducting research. And so that to me is the biggest perk, I guess I would say. You know, it is a shame that you won't have as many people able to take tours, but if I understand what Ben has said and what I've read, that there still will be opportunities. There'll just be fewer opportunities. But, you know, I hope the trust is around for a long time. And so over the years, many people will be able to have that experience.
Ben Beck, can you tell us how we find out more about the Great Ape Trust of Iowa and how maybe you'll be a lucky one to be able to visit it in the future?
Well, the best thing, we haven't decided on our visitation program yet. So what I would suggest is that people go to our website, www.greatapetrust.org, where you can read all about the bonobo research program. You can read about our conservation program in Rwanda and link to this wonderful series of articles that was recently done by Perry Beeman in the Des Moines Register about Rwanda and our program there. And then as the details of the visitation program for 2010 come online, folks will be able to read about it.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Ben Beck of the Great Ape Trust of Iowa, joining us from our Des Moines studio. Jill Preetz of Iowa State University, joining us from our studio in Ames. Jill and Ben, thank you very much for this wonderful hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. And bye, Jill.
Bye, Ben. Thanks.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. And podcasting available. If you caught part of the program, would like to hear the whole hour, go to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.